please rise? The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Bentley, Judge Cleary, the Honorable Michelle Larkin presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to start by apologizing for our delayed start this morning. I take full responsibility for that. I don't mean to inconvenience all of you. We have three cases on our court for oral argument this morning. The first is Amana versus Diara, and I should state for the record, it's May 15th, 2025. For the record, we'll need each attorney to introduce his or herself for the recording that's being made of the hearing before each leg of your argument. We are ready for argument from counsel for appellant. Please approach and introduce yourself.
May it please the court. My name is Ryan Breeze with Sajak Law Firm, counsel for the appellant, Brahma Diara.
Oh, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. Mr. Diara, in this appeal, cites several bases for reversal of both the overall issuance of the order of protection as well as certain terms of the order of protection. This matter highlights some of the remaining ambiguities in the order for protection statute under Minnesota Statute 518B.01. Some of these ambiguities can lead, and I believe have led in this matter, to the OFP statute being utilized as a sword against those who face allegations under an OFP action rather than a shield to protect victims of abuse. The purpose of the OFP statute is to protect victims of abuse from abusers in a remedial, equitable, and non-punitive manner, and many other states have pointed out the similarity of an OFP to a civil injunction. As such, OFPs rely on a reasonable belief that there is an action to enjoin. Where there is no threat of an action to enjoin, there is no basis for an OFP. Further, it's well established that allegations by a petitioning party that lack specificity are not sufficient on their own to establish a finding of the occurrence of abuse, threats, or overt action constituting domestic abuse, as set forth by the court in Burgum v. Burgum, 392 Northwest 2nd, 604.
Counsel, when you suggest that they aren't specific, are you talking about the timing of them?
The timing in relation to, are you referring to the time of
when the various domestic assault allegations?
Right, yes. So specifically, as I recount in our brief, most, if not all, the allegations could not be pinned to hardly a year, let alone a date that they occurred on. So it made it incredibly difficult for Mr. Diara to make any defense against these claims when they are claimed. Miss Amana would say 2012, 2013, somewhere in there. There's the passport incident where she refers 3 to 6 months ago. She cited January 1st, 2024 as it happening, yet it's unlikely that that was the date because most of the offices that she would have been at would have been closed due to the holiday. There was even an original in the petition, a cite of 2019 of an incident, and it was later determined that it was likely 2012 when that incident occurred. And so the specificity of the time is essential to those claims to give Mr. Diara a valid chance to defend himself against such claims. In addition, all but the passport incident and all of the physical abuse allegations occurred more than 10 years before bringing this action.
Well, except the Thompsons, which suggests that that's not important.
Correct. And that's what we're going to be discussing in some depth here. In Thompson v. Shermshire, 906 Northwest 2nd, 495, the court in there created a distinct departure from over 30 years of precedence of requiring a temporal connection between the allegations of abuse and the time of bringing the action. And I understand that they have taken a strict constructionist view in saying it does not say that it has to be temporal in time, but that is important for many reasons here. I'll just jump into that then now. So Thompson addresses both subdivision 2A1 and 2A2 of what constitutes domestic abuse. And Thompson specifically cites that 2A2 does have a temporal requirement. So the threats have to be temporal to the bringing of the action. And that is well established. They cite that as a reason that the legislature knows how to create a temporal connection to a required event. And so that applies to the passport incident in this instance where it was alleged threats to have been made by Mr. Diarra, the content of which we'll get into more later.
Counsel, can I just ask for clarification? Did the district court make findings regarding the threats at the passport office and rely on those findings as a basis for the OFP?
As one of the basis, yes. I believe they used both the past domestic abuse as well as the threats as the basis to issue the order for protection.
Well, I mean, specifically the alleged incident at the passport
yes,
office.
I believe so. The question of temporal relationship as regards physical abuse comes to light in regards to 518B.01, subdivision 6.
Counsel, I'm going to follow up
here
on the last question. I'm looking at the findings, and I'm trying to decide what paragraph covers the passport office.
Oh.
My recollection is that the district court did not make findings on that, and if the district court did not make findings on that, I don't know if that would be the basis for a finding of harm justifying reversal.
Okay. I will bypass that point for the time being. So as regards to the allegations of physical abuse, the statute does address in subdivision 6, subpoint G, as potential relief, restriction of firearms against a person who an order of protection has been found against. And then in subpoint I, it cites that to establish that firearm restriction, it requires an imminent threat of physical harm to the person to make that finding. And so that then does draw back into case that there is a temporal requirement, perhaps not specifically of the physical abuse, but of a showing of imminent threat of harm to the petitioner.
So doesn't that, like even if we were to take that point that for the firearm restriction you'd need some kind of finding of imminent harm or risk of harm, doesn't that just mean that the district court, if it didn't make such a finding, shouldn't have imposed the firearm restriction? But
that
why is,
that,
as I understood your argument, but correct me if I'm wrong, that you were reading that limitation as applying to the bodily harm prong in the first instance. So can you help clarify, is that just limited to the firearm restriction?
I believe it could be expanded to the entirety of it, but it does specifically apply to the firearm restriction, which is essential for Mr. Brema. As cited, he is a security guard, and as he moves up in his career, it will be necessary for him to be able to obtain a firearm. And so that is an essential part of his need in this case, is to have that restriction reversed. Because of Thompson talks about the melding of the statute together and trying to read it as a whole. And so, yes, it does draw into question saying if they do have an imminent threat of harm requirement for the firearm restriction, does that apply to the entirety of the issuance of the statute? If it has the firearm restriction, I would say yes, but I'm also open to that it just applies only to the firearm restriction. But as I said, that is still an essential part of what Mr. Brema is seeking relief here for.
All right, so then as to that specific error, the district court's failure to make a finding of imminency of harm and therefore should not have issued the firearm restriction, that doesn't necessarily mean the whole OFP is invalid.
Not necessarily, no. From here, I'm going to quickly work in reverse order and address the issue under our point two, that the district court erred in ordering appellant to make ongoing payments on the party's homestead, mortgage, and utilities, as Minnesota Statute 518B.01 does not provide this remedy as a basis for relief. So the Thompson Court's decision made a reliance on strict construction of statutory language of 518B.01. They set aside 30-plus years of precedence regarding the issue of temporal connection. However, taking their view, we then look at the remedies available to the court in ordering relief. And so the court, or the statute, sets out in great detail the potential of relief that is available with the issuance of the order of protection, including child support, including spousal maintenance, including ejecting a party from the home. All of these are valid under the statute. However, the court did issue child support against Mr. Brema, but they declined to order spousal maintenance against him, but instead ordered him that he was financially responsible to pay for the house and the utilities ongoing. Now, this is a difficulty because had the court ordered spousal maintenance, they would have had to go through the statutory standard of determining if spousal maintenance was appropriate. Mr. Brema, again, is a very limited means. I believe the order cites something to the effect of $3,600 a month as his income. And so with that, the court put Mr. Brema in an extremely difficult position, in a point where he was at threat of violating the order of protection and having to choose between paying for his necessities of life or paying for the mortgage and utilities that he is that he has to pay under the statute.
Didn't the district court make a finding kind of the inverse of that, which is that if the mortgage and utilities weren't part of the order, that it would in effect force the individual seeking the OFP to leave the house?
I mean, that is definitely a question. But again, this is where Thompson comes into effect, that Thompson has a strict construction, that had the legislator wanted to intend that they still be required to make payment on the house, payment on the utilities, those sorts of things, they could have provided for it in that statute. And
well,
they specifically
did. The legislature did include this kind of catch-all. It says, in its discretion, the court can order other relief as it deems necessary for the protection of a family or a household member. So why, I guess I'm wondering, do you have any authority as to why this would exceed the bounds of the court's discretion?
I would posit that other than citing to other statutes, such as the child support statute, such as the spousal maintenance statute, all other remedies available are restrictions on the individual, not proactive obligations on the individual. So this goes past just simply restricting him from doing something and puts a proactive obligation, which, again, he may not have the ability to do, and essentially creates the position for debtor's prison. If he fails to make those payments, he is now subject to a violation of the order for protection, a criminal offense. And it's not similar to a child support enforcement where it's a remedial where they take contempt action, collection action, whatnot against him, but rather this is a criminal action that he is now subject to for an inability to pay on this.
So the statute provides for other affirmative relief, spousal maintenance is one. That's different. That's not a restriction. That's a affirmative.
Right.
So it's not to say that would be inappropriate, but it sounds like what I'm hearing is, and let me know if this is a fair characterization, that this was in effect a spousal maintenance order.
Yes, it should have, but it
didn't go through the spousal maintenance process to determine whether he had the means to pay.
Right, and whether that was purposeful or not, it was convenient that they did not have to make that evaluation of the standards, and that's why I said, except where they refer to other statutes, because again, child support has protections to ensure that a party can still maintain their own necessities and pay for themselves. Spousal maintenance also does that same measure. So in those situations where they're ordering a proactive obligation on the party, there is protections already in place by reference of the statutes that are used to determine those things. But here, there is no restriction on that and no determination as to whether or not he actually has the ability to fulfill this obligation that he is criminally liable for failing to do so.
So is your argument more that
It was an abuse of discretion to order payment of spousal maintenance without having more information to consider regarding ability to pay and whatnot, as opposed to you can't order payment of the mortgage. I'm sorry, spousal maintenance.
I would posit that both are correct, but yes, that is definitely a position that could be that they did effectively order spousal maintenance without doing the test according to the statute to make that determination.
Well, I'm just thinking more broadly. I mean, if a district court, you know, just says you're ordered to pay the mortgage and there's no information in the record indicating that he has paid the mortgage, he's capable of paying the mortgage, would that be an abuse of discretion?
If they went through that practice?
Yes.
No, I do not believe that would be an abuse of discretion then.
Counsel, this is an OFP hearing that led to this. Has there been a temporary hearing at any point in family court for relief?
On the OFP?
No, not on the OFP, for relief. In other words, has the...
No, he did not bring any subsequent motion.
Okay.
I have 10 seconds if the court has any final question.
I don't see any questions. You'll have some 5 minutes on rebuttal if
you
choose to use it. We'll now hear from counsel for respondent. Who's arguing this morning?
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning. Do you need to adjust the podium? You can. If you need to, it goes up and down.
I might. All right, can you hear me
now?
Yes,
thank you.
Great. May I begin?
You may.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Holly Harrell with Green Aspel PLLP on behalf of respondent Ms. Kumealo Amana. Your Honors, the district court heard from five witnesses over 3 days of testimony before finding not just one act of domestic abuse within the meaning of the statute, but four, including three acts of physical harm against Ms. Amana. Based on those findings and based on the entire evidentiary record, the court, within its discretion, awarded the order for protection. Mr. Diarra's arguments that there is a temporal requirement for acts of domestic abuse is a question of statutory interpretation that fails under the clear and binding rule of the Minnesota Supreme Court decision in Thompson.
What about the gun restriction? The statute specifically says there must be a finding of immediacy there.
Your Honor, Mr. Diarra's arguments there conflate different subdivisions of the statute. So stepping back, the statute provides that the court, after a finding of domestic abuse, may order relief. And the relief that is authorized is enumerated in Section G of the statute. In Subdivision 6 of the statute. Although Mr. Diarra attempts to distinguish Thompson on the basis of Subdivision 6I, his arguments here conflate Subdivision 6I with Subdivision 6G, which is the specific provision under which the court...
I'm talking about the specific provision, 6G. When the court issues an order containing a firearms restriction provided for in paragraph G, the court shall determine by preponderance of the evidence if an abusing party poses an imminent risk of causing another person substantial bodily harm. My precise question is, can there be a firearm restriction if the court has not made a finding that the abusing party poses an imminent risk of causing another person substantial bodily harm?
Yes, Your Honor, there can.
Under
Subdivision 6I, the additional findings requiring the court to determine if the abusing party poses an imminent risk, that only applies if the court then goes on to order the immediate possession, taking immediate possession of the guns under that 6I. Under 6G, the court does not need to make that additional finding to order the taking of firearms or the prohibition against having firearms. It is only then upon that additional finding that the court may order the immediate taking of possession of the guns.
But the order is in effect in that he cannot own or possess firearms. That feels immediate to me.
If looking at the language of the statute, there are two distinct subdivisions here, and the order that the court made was an order under subdivision 6G. Looking at the language of the statute, it says an order granting relief shall prohibit the abusing party from possessing firearms for the length the order is in effect if the order, one, restrains the abusing party from harassing, stalking, or threatening the petitioner, or restrains the abusing party from engaging in other conduct that would place the petitioner in reasonable fear of bodily injury, and two, includes a finding that the abusing party represents a credible threat to the physical safety of the petitioner or prohibits the abusing party from using, attempting to use, or threatening to use physical force against the petitioner. That is all that is required to issue relief under subdivision 6G. And that, if the court looks at the court's order under...
Counsel, we have a copy of the law, too. We're familiar with it. The point I guess I'm trying to make is that this restriction applies when the order went in effect into the future. So from then on, he cannot own firearms under this OFP, at least for the two-year period.
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. And the court was within its discretion to order that relief under 6G. The court
without a finding of immediacy.
Yes, Your Honor, because the finding of immediacy under subdivision 6I, it goes to the additional relief that was not ordered here. Under 6I, after the court determines by a preponderance of the evidence if the abusing party poses an imminent risk, then, quote, upon a finding of imminent risk, the court shall order that the local law enforcement agency take immediate possession of all firearms. That is a different relief from 6G,
I think perhaps what Judge Clary is getting at is form over substance. I mean, what is the difference between saying I'm taking immediate possessions of firearms that you currently possess and you may never possess a firearm? I know there's a practical difference, mm-hmm. but in reality, from the time of that order, the subject or the person who's prohibited by the order may not possess a firearm.
That's true, Your Honor, but what the additional finding under 6I goes to is requiring that the additional finding for the immediate possession. And why the legislature decided to set up the statute as it did, I can't say, but under Thompson, the court notes that we cannot conflate different subdivisions in different sections of the statute. That was what Cass had improperly done in interpreting the definition of domestic abuse. Here, subdivision G does not require the finding of posing an imminent risk, but subdivision I does. And the lack of a temporal requirement in subdivision G means that there did not have to be that finding of immediacy here.
Well, let me see if I'm tracking this. So G says an order shall prohibit the abusing party from possessing firearms for the length if it, one, restrains the abusing party from harassing, stalking, or threatening, or restrains the abusing party from engaging in other conduct. So that's one kind of what piece of the order. The second is it includes a finding that the abusing party represents a credible threat to the physical safety of petitioner. So is your point that the court had to find, in order to impose a firearm restriction, had to find a credible threat to the physical safety, or just that it prohibits the use of force, but not any kind of imminency from the ban? And you're saying that then you read I is only applying to taking away firearms that somebody already has. And if they're taken away, if there's an imminent, they have to, but don't they have to do the imminent risk analysis either way? Because I think that's where we're struggling, because the language in I says when a court issues an order containing a firearms restriction in G, mm-hmm. it shall determine by a preponderance of evidence if an abusing party poses an imminent risk. So doesn't it have to do that either way? And maybe your point is that even if they don't find an imminent risk, they can still pose a general ban if there are no... Now I'm kind of in my head about it.
No, it does... I mean, the
statute just clearly says, when a court issues an order containing a firearms restriction provided for in paragraph G, the court shall determine there's an imminent risk. I mean, doesn't that say that? You can't issue a firearms restriction under paragraph G unless you've determined there's an imminent risk.
I would respectfully disagree with that interpretation, Your Honor, because under G, if the court makes the findings, which...
I understand what G says, but in 6I, it refers to G and says if you're going to make the findings under G, you also have to make a finding of imminent risk.
Yes, I agree that it does say that. And if the court finds that there is an imminent risk, then something additional happens. The court shall order the immediate taking away of
and what if it
guns.
Doesn't find an imminent risk?
Then we go back to subdivision 6G and the requirements set out there, which include restraining the abusing party. I won't set it forth again.
So or in practical application, how this would work is, let's say the person has firearms. The court doesn't make a finding of imminent risk but imposes a restriction under G. So the court's without authority to order law enforcement to take possession of the firearms. It would then be incumbent upon the person who's been restricted to dispose of his firearms. So that would be a way to reconcile this.
Under subdivision 6G, there are actually specifically set out procedures for taking the guns on any firearms that are in the possession of the respondent on a more elongated timeline. So there,
who takes them?
The abusing party may transfer the possession.
Okay, so
yes, you're right. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The statute anticipates a situation where there's no finding of immediate harm.
Yes.
The abusing party has possession of firearms. Mm-hmm. A restriction is imposed saying you cannot possess them, but because there's been no finding of immediacy, the abusing party has to do something else to dispossess himself of the firearms.
That's
within
exactly
three business
right.
days as opposed to imminent, immediate
acquisition by law enforcement.
By law enforcement. Yeah, right. Right. Law Got enforcement it. Must immediately take it versus then the exception in G is saying except as in I, the court then allows them to transfer it within three business days to a federal. Okay.
That makes sense.
Think more. I appreciate the nuance.
No, yeah, thank you both. And I think between the two questions, we've landed on it. I do just want to point out that the court's order for protection at page 5, paragraph 18, does make the findings that are required under subdivision D. Under subdivision G. And the court did find on the record that Mr. Diarra did not possess firearms, and so it functionally declined to make additional findings that would be necessary under subdivision I. And the court's finding that...
But just so I'm going to be clear myself here, in ordering that, the court had to find G. It had to find a basis for restricting his use of firearms in the future, correct?
The court had to satisfy the requirements of subdivision G, and it did so.
So presumably that includes a finding that abusing party represents a credible threat to physical safety?
Actually, the plain language of the statute allows the court under that subpart 2 of G to prohibit the abusing party from using
Right.
Guns.
No, I understand. But that means the court found the need for restraint and found a credible threat to physical safety, correct?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because there is an injunctive or under subpart 2 there, and the court took the option under the or.
Okay. So what finding does the court need to make to restrict firearms, even if you don't own them? In the future, you can't own them. What finding do you need to make under this statute?
I don't think the court has to make a specific finding under the plain language of this statute.
To restrict someone's right under the Second Amendment to own firearms.
I do not read a requirement for a finding under the plain language of subdivision 6G, but that's not an argument that the appellant made, Your Honor.
Okay. All right.
I'm sorry, just so I understand, when you're saying there's not a requirement for a finding, I mean, the court does need to apply, I mean, in G, the two, there's G1 and G2, so it has to...
But two
oh, just if the
injunctive.
Order, I guess there has to be some kind of assessment that the order restrains the party in the circumstances provided, and that either there's a credible threat or that the order prohibits the abusing party from using, attempting to use, or threatening to use physical force.
That's correct.
So as long as the so-called findings, is your point that the court doesn't need to expressly make those findings so long as the order itself orders those, something that satisfies each of those provisions?
That's right, Your Honor.
Well, now I'm confused because that's what I asked. Judge Bentley just asked the same question. They had to make that finding there, right?
No, Your Honor. And so,
how do you restrict it without, what's your authority to restrict firearms if you're the judge?
The court had to satisfy the requirements of Subdivision G, which it did by restraining the abusing party from harassing and by prohibiting the abusing party from using or threatening to use physical force.
But it includes the finding that there's a credible threat to physical safety. That was my question at the beginning. That's one of the two requirements.
Your Honor, that is part of two, but subsection two there includes a disjunctive clause. And so under section two there, it says includes a finding
where did the court specify that in the findings under G?
Your Honor, I don't think under subdivision G the court is required to make a finding that the abusing party makes a credible threat, at least explicitly.
So we're supposed to guess which one of those applied?
No, Your Honor, because under and two, the court complied with that requirement by making an order that prohibits the abusing party from using, attempting to use, or threatening to use physical force against the petitioner.
Okay, where does that say?
So that's under subdivision 6G.
No, I don't mean the statute. Oh. Where does it say that in the findings?
That's on page 5, paragraph 18. You'll notice the language there almost exactly tracks the requirement here under 6G, using the abusing party language.
And so your position is that I does not apply, therefore?
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor. And again, I do want to emphasize that the court did specifically ask Mr. Giara and credited his testimony that he did not possess firearms, and so there was no need to order the taking away of his firearms immediately.
Can I ask you a question?
Of course.
This is unrelated to what our discussion just now. As regards the mortgage and utilities issue, are you aware of any case law that suggests under that catch-all provision of A13 that when we're talking about order and its discretion, other relief as it deems necessary for the protection of a family or household member, et cetera, could include mortgage and utilities rather than protection as we normally think of protection? In other words, mortgage and utilities are usually ordered in a temporary hearing in a civil court, and the court seems to put it in this OFP. Your response? Are you aware of any case law on this?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of any specific case law that allows that, but under the plain language of the statute, the court does have the discretion to fashion that additional relief, and I would argue that it was both complementary to the order awarding Ms. Amana possession of the house.
Well, I wish it was plain language. I mean, it's very open, but it doesn't seem to be very, very specific as to how far that goes.
I would agree with Your Honor, but I think the order here was certainly within the court's discretion, both because it functionally allowed Ms. Amana to continue enjoying the possession of the home, which otherwise could have been foreclosed by the bank. The record here, the factual record was clear that she was a very limited financial means. And the factual record also established that Mr. Diara, prior to Ms. Amana's filing of the petition, was paying the mortgage and was paying the utilities. The record also established that during the pendency of the matter, Mr. Diara stopped paying for the internet. And so the court sort of properly held the status quo of the pre-petition filing by ordering him to continue payments he had already been making.
I understand, and it's very logical, all of it, but it is a criminal proceeding. I mean, he's subject to criminal penalties here under the OFP for 2 years. The normal course would be to go into family court under a temporary hearing and get an order having him do all those things civilly, pay the mortgage, pay the utilities, pay whatever else it is. True? And that's a civil proceeding.
Your Honor, I would argue that the statute with its broad language allowing the court to order the remedy relief as it deems necessary for protection does authorize this, and whether another procedure might have also allowed it does not change what the statute authorizes here. Okay. I would also note that under the case law, the statute should be construed liberally in favor of the abused party. That's under Pekovnik, the court's decision in Pekovnik, which we cite in our brief. Your Honors, I see my time has long expired, apparently.
Are there additional questions?
Are there?
Can you just respond to the to our conversation with your colleague that this in effect was like a spousal mate? I mean, it just seems like should the court have somehow at least made findings as to ability to pay before making this type of affirmative order?
Your Honor, while the court did make specific findings about ability to pay in ordering the child support that it did, the court may have considered the fact that Mr. Diarra was also previously paying the mortgage and the utilities in reaching the discretionary relief.
Do you know in the record, were those payments made while he was not living in the home?
They were, Your Honor. He continued to make those payments even when he did not live in the home. Please.
There are no further questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. Amano would respectfully request that the court affirm the decision below in all respects. Thank you.
Once more for the record, would you begin with your name before presenting rebuttal argument?
Yes. Ryan Breeze on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Brema Diarra. Regarding the issue of the requirement to pay the mortgage and the utilities, again, it is essential that they did not do any testing of determine ability to pay in this situation. Without such, there would essentially be a limitless standard for what they could order him to pay ongoing and within reason.
We have findings and evidence that after he moved out of the house, he continued to pay the mortgage and utilities. So isn't that a factual basis for the district court to conclude he has the ability to continue to pay the mortgage and utilities?
He continued to pay the mortgage and utilities. He also kept a room at the residence, as was set forth in the testimony at trial.
So you're saying when he was paying the mortgage and utilities, he was living at?
He maintained a room that he would...
Oh, a locked room, a storage room. But
yes.
He was living elsewhere.
He was living elsewhere, is my understanding, yes, that's correct.
So isn't that sufficient evidence for the judge to conclude that he has the ability to pay the mortgage when there's record evidence that he was no longer living at the home and yet he was paying the mortgage and paying the utilities?
I would pose no, especially given the rise of legal situation then, as he was going to begin incurring substantial legal fees, both in the order of protection matter as well as any subsequent divorce matter.
Was a dissolution proceeding initiated?
It has been initiated, yes.
Okay. And was there a temporary hearing at that?
There has not been.
Okay. And at that temporary hearing, could your client not say, got this OFP, it requires me to pay the mortgage, I can't do it, we need to adjust this? I mean, just I'm familiar with district court proceedings. The two cases often are considered together in determining, and one might modify the order of the other and start to take precedence. Like, if we're now getting into the finance and visitation and custody, family court decides that with greater detail under statutes that require more findings and can then change the OFP to reflect what's been determined in the family law proceeding.
But again, the fact that they ordered this as general relief doesn't give him a specific standard to go off of which he could modify. So spousal maintenance has a standard for how you can modify spousal maintenance. If you just ordered...
But what I'm saying, just practically speaking, the way this works is you get to the dissolution proceeding, there's a temporary hearing, there are arguments about how much he should pay. while the dissolution is pending. He makes his best case, and he tries to convince the judge, like, look, I can't pay the full mortgage. Would you set a lower amount? Then we're going to ask the judge in the OFP case to modify the OFP consistent with what's been determined in the dissolution case, because the dissolution case is the case in which we're going to apply all these formulas and statutes and take a harder look at the issue than we were in the OFP hearing.
And I would say that the reverse is just as much true, that, you know, he's now hung for several months of having to pay this.
Okay. Let me ask you about the statutory language 518B016A in terms of various forms of relief which may be granted. Eight is award temporary use and possession of the property. So that's essentially what the district court did. She gets to continue to live there. And this is the phrase that interests me. And restrain one or both parties from transferring, encumbering, concealing, or disposing of the property, except in the usual course of business. I mean, could that not be read to say, I've got evidence that he's been paying the mortgage even though he's not living there. I want her to continue to live there with the kids. I don't want him to do anything to jeopardize possession of the residence. So in an effort to prevent him from disposing of the property or encumbering the property, I'm going to order him to keep paying the mortgage.
I would say that provision is, again, a restriction. It restricts him from taking actions. It does not put on him a proactive obligation.
But
such as
to say, I'm preventing you from disposing of the property by ordering you to pay the mortgage.
And that's where I say would be the differentiation, and that this was intended, again, more for, you know, can't go selling off the house, you can't go, you know, selling the gold, whatever, to pay for things. You can't actively do something. We will restrict you from doing something, but we can't proactively force you to do something on an ongoing basis.
You could think about that differently. I mean, the status quo was he was paying it. So why wasn't the court restricting him from stopping that payment? I mean, you can use that word either way. Here, he was already paying, and if anything, the court just ordered the status quo with respect to the house, as opposed to ordering him affirmatively to start paying it. It seems like it said we're restricting you from stopping the payment.
And that's, I guess that's the question is, again, yes, he has to continue. Yes, he was paying, but the circumstances have changed as well. As I said, he is incurring additional fees now. He is.
But that's where he goes into the family court and asks for a more specific order or asks for modification of this order.
Well, and that's what I would say, that she has the absolute right to do the same.
But she's not complaining about the order. You are. You're here asking for us to reverse this district court's OFP when there's an abuse of discretion standard. The statute's supposed to be liberally interpreted to provide relief and protect people from domestic abuse. I mean, it's hard to show an abuse of discretion as long as there's evidence in the record to provide a factual basis for what the district court did. I mean, I would hear your argument if we had no evidence in the record regarding who was paying the mortgage, what the mortgage is, and whether or not he can pay it. But those aren't the circumstances.
Right. But again, my position, and this is why Thompson is so important, Thompson takes a strict view of it. And so just as much they could have said, no, you don't have him required to pay, you can go to family court and request that he pay ongoing on the mortgage and things like that, because it's not provided for relief under the OFP statute. And this is where we talk about that the OFP statute has become so expansive.
It has.
And that it's become used as a sword and not a shield as it originally intended.
All right. Your time is up. We appreciate the arguments from both attorneys and your willingness to answer our questions. The case is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days.
Thank you, Your Honor.